Committee format, since we don't have a quorum here, we're going to take testimony on some bills until the event that we get additional members here so that we might go to work session later. We're going to take the bills out of order. We're going to start with Senate Bill 388. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 388 and ask Senator Metzger to come forward, please.
Thank you, Chairman Starr, Senator Morissette, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today. Senate Bill 388, you'll hear some testimony both from individuals in my district and I think elsewhere and from the Oregon School Activities Association today. And I will be very brief. This is an issue about providing certainty to schools when those very difficult decisions that the OSA faces year in and year out about moving schools to different districts. You'll hear an experience in my district of what brought this bill before you today. Having said that, having talked with the Oregon School Activities Association, who I will say has been very forthcoming and very cooperative in sharing the same values I think we all do, and that is in making sure we have the best education we can for kids and also making sure they have activities available to them. We have worked collaboratively on Senate Bill 388. You have a -2 amendment, so the bill as printed will be significantly modified, which we've reached an agreement with the OSAA, and I'm glad to be partner with them in adopting rules that the state board will adopt for the standards by which districts will have their schools moved when the OSAA, as they often have to do, make these decisions. But so that everyone will understand what the playing field is and what the rules are, and provide perhaps some help from some of the uncertainty that has happened in the past. And so I applaud both my school districts and the Oregon School Activities Association in working hand in hand on this issue. That again will be the -2 amendment, but I wanted you to know we've reached an agreement on that, and I've been very, very pleased at how well everyone has worked on this issue.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Now, should we speak to it?
I think we will. We'll say.
We will speak. Yeah. Okay, that's fine.
I'm going to invite OSAA representative to come forward and talk to us first of all about the work in progress and the substance of the -2 amendments, and then we'll have those folks who are initiators of the bill to come forward and talk to us.
Senator Starr and Senator Morissette, thank you very much. I'm Tom Welter. I'm the executive director of the Oregon School Activities Association. With me is Michael Walmark, assistant executive director of the OSAA. Thank you very much for taking the time to share with us this afternoon. Senate Bill 388 in its initial form was something that we could not support, and I want to go through a little bit about the process that we have used in the past in reclassifying and redistricting schools. Before we do that, I would like to just share a little bit about who the OSAA is. We're authorized by the state legislature by statute. Every 5 years, all of our rules, regulations, and policies are approved by the State Board of Education to govern and monitor the interscholastic activity programs that we sponsor in our member schools. We currently have 287 member high schools across the state of Oregon, 232 public schools, and 55 private schools. In addition to those 287 full member schools, we also have associate membership with 37 other small private schools who do not offer programs, but their students are allowed to participate in their resident public school because they don't offer programs themselves. Each year, we conduct 80 state championship activities in 16 different activities. Approximately 115,000 students participated in the programs that we sponsored during the last year. We are not a unique organization. Every state has a comparable organization to the OSAA, including the District of Columbia. We belong nationally to a group called the National Federation of State High School Associations, and we set common rules for high school athletics all across the country. The OSA is actually a voluntary organization. The schools themselves form the association, and they themselves govern the association. The 287 schools that I referred to are divided into four classifications based upon their enrollment. And then those 287 schools are further divided into 30 leagues, depending upon their location. We have a delegate assembly consisting of one elected representative from each of those 30 leagues, 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A. We also include in our delegate assembly an athletic director representative, a representative from the Oregon School Boards Association, and an activities director. So we have 33 voting members. They can change the rules, regulations, and the constitution of this organization. They meet twice a year, once in October and once in April. We also have elected representatives from our executive board. Those are seven members elected by the delegate assembly, by the member schools, representing superintendents and principals across the state. And also included are the athletic director of the Oregon School Boards Association, and the activities director. So we have 10 voting members on our executive board, along with the Coaches Association advisory member. They meet four times a year in September, December, February, and May. They're responsible for more of the day-to-day operation of the association, dealing with school violations, sanctions, appeals, the budget of the association, that type of thing. I'd now like to turn it over to Mr. Walmark to walk through exactly what we do on a regular basis when we look at schools in terms of what classification and what district they should be placed in.
Thank you, Senator Starr and Senator Morissette. As you consider the amendment that has been proposed, I think
for the record, we need your name.
I'm sorry. Name is Mike Walmark, and I am the Assistant Executive Director of the Oregon School Activities Association. I think it might be helpful as we talk about the proposed amendment to compare what it is calling for versus the way in which the OSA currently handles classification and redistricting process. In my 17 years within the association, I have four times been through that process, last two times as the staff person that works with the classification and redistricting committee. So let me just briefly tell you about that process as a basis for consideration of the proposal that you're looking at. It is both necessary and controversial that the OSAA reclassify every 4 years. It is necessary because schools change in their enrollments and change classification, so we have to move them to a new league. And it's controversial because no matter what is done, always that is considered from the viewpoint of the individual school. So from the perspective of school A, if they are changing leagues, it has an impact on them, but it also has an impact on the schools that were in the league that they left and on the schools in the league into which they are moving, and depending on which chair you're sitting in, you would say that was a great move, or you might say that was not such a great move. So it's similar in concept, I suppose, to school boundary revisions, and I think perhaps if you've ever been involved with those, you know how difficult they are. It's similar in some respect, I suppose, also to legislative reapportionment. We have to do it based on changes in our association, but when we do it, we enter knowing that it's going to reach an outcome that's not going to be satisfactory to everybody. And with that in recognition in mind, with an impact that is potentially so great, the member schools of the OSAA have specified in the OSAA Constitution the timelines, process, and criteria to be followed. So they have been consistent during my 16 years, and briefly, using the most recent of our reclassification process as an example, let me tell you how that works. A committee called the Classification and Redistricting Committee is formed. It's a 10-member committee mirroring in its composition the OSAA Executive Board, which is from schools all over the state of Oregon of various different sizes and from different regions. The committee is charged with gathering information under Article 6 of the OSA Constitution and making recommendations to the executive board regarding classification of district assignments four-year time block. So every 4 years, we set the leagues around the state, and then at the end of 4 years, we check and, as necessary, make the revisions in the leagues based on the changes that have come about with schools that have changed classification or perhaps new schools that have been added that didn't exist at the time the leagues were initially formed. In this case, for the classification and districting committee that dealt with the 2002-2006 four-year time block, there were seven public meetings that were held. If we recognize going in, and I think I mentioned this before, that there's going to be some that are dissatisfied with the final outcome based upon the impact that it had on them, we feel it's incumbent upon us to make sure that there's ample opportunity for them to express their concerns so there's an opportunity for the board to consider them. And so we have a series of hearings hearings not dissimilar to the one that we're having today, in which the OSAA Classification Redistricting Committee listens to testimony and also receives written testimony from schools that are potentially affected by changes in classification and districting. In the particular case of our last go-round, we had meetings in November of 2000, January of 2001, February of 2001, March 2001, April of 2001, and October of 2001, all of which were intended to gather information for the committee so that they could make a recommendation to the executive board as to what changes should be coming about. And then on December of 2001, the board adopted the new time block that went into effect in the fall of 2002. Add it all together, and we've got a process that is almost a year and a half in length, during which a great deal of testimony and information is received prior to a decision that is made. Public testimony is allowed. Written testimony is allowed. Last time we went through the process, for example, there were 162 items of written correspondence received that were cataloged and then reviewed by the committee before they made their decision. And following every one of the meetings during the course of that whole process, there is an update following the meeting that is sent to all of the superintendents, principals, and athletic directors of the 287 member schools of the OSAA, and is also posted on our website so other people who are interested in this process have an opportunity to know what's taking place. The bottom line, I think, is kind of symbolically shown in this handbook, which is the one that I created in our last classification districting process go-round. It includes all of the correspondence that we received, all of the process, and finally a recommendation that went to the OSA Executive Board. I guess the thing that I would like to impress upon you is our belief that we do now follow a constitutionally mandated, deliberate, careful, lengthy, and we hope fair process with repeated opportunities to provide suggestions and responses to both the committee and the executive board trying to making classifications decisions. And there are always going to be some disagreement with the final outcome, but we hope that the process is fair, and we believe that the amendment that you are going to be considering to allow the state superintendent of public instruction to take a look at that or to approve the process that is followed by the OSAA. We certainly are not opposed to that because we believe our process is a good one.
May I?
Yes.
Now, if I were to do some independent research and look up the reclassification criteria in your Constitution, would I look under Article 6 or under Article 9?
You would look under Article 9, which is where the Classification and Districting Committee is defined.
I think you said Article 6.
Article 6 gives a charge to the committee. It says what the purpose of the committee is.
Okay.
Article 9 explains the workings of the individual committee.
Okay. I don't. Good. Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions?
I believe that sets the stage. What I had, I think what I heard was that the review by the Department of Education of your criteria was satisfactory to you, and that if we choose to move forward, that you have no opposition to that.
That is correct.
That's accurate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have several folks signed up, and I'm probably going to have a little trouble with reading we got Jeff Baker, Steve Fish, and Rick Bills. Is that right?
First one was right.
First one. I got one right.
I'll fish quite a bit, though. It's nothing personal.
Disc?
Yes, sir.
All right. I appreciate your being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And who's going to lead off?
I'll lead off. Thank you, Senator Starr, Senator Morissette.
Give us your name for
my
the record.
My name is Jeff Baker. I'm the attorney for the Hood River County School District. Last year, Hood River County School District was faced with the redistricting process that was just explained to you by the OSAA. Through that process, we identified a situation I think that this legislation is designed to correct. The situation, first of all, starts from the fact that no one had ever appealed a redistricting decision in the history of the OSAA, as far as we could tell. So there wasn't much guidance on how this procedure should go. Prior to that, the criteria that was mentioned by the OSAA representatives just now was, and it's laid out in Article 9, listed some considerations that the OSAA should follow in as part of the redistricting decisions. In doing so, it lays out, and I think it's worth hearing what these are. It's geography, cost of travel, scheduling problems, league balance, league history, move as few schools as possible, enrollment, and maintain schools in the same district in the same league. Those are the criteria that they use in their own constitution in order to make these decisions. As part of that process, they polled the superintendents in the 4A and 3A level and asked them what the criteria they thought would be most important in doing that. After all, it is a voluntary association, so they were seeking input from their members as to the criteria that they should use. The criteria that were put back to them were cost. The top ones were cost, minimizing the loss of instruction time, and school size and geography. Frankly, that makes sense because that's the problem that drives the fiscal crisis that we're in now with schools is the cost of athletics. And if you can maintain a reasonable cost on that, you're going to be able to keep as many activities available for as many kids as possible. So through that process, they reached a conclusion that the Hood River School District should be moved from the Mount Hood Conference to the Intermountain Conference. The testimony that we presented throughout that process and at the later appeal showed that was going to be an increase in cost, it was going to reduce class time, and it was going to be significantly greater distances for our teams to travel throughout the school seasons. After that process, when we filed the appeal, we were faced with the problem of not having clear guidelines as to how that was to proceed. The Department of Education appointed a hearings representative. The hearings representative laid out what he thought was the proper standard of review in this case, and basically that standard of review was whether or not the OSAA had broken any laws. We argued that the standard was not that loose and that they really had to have substantial evidence in the record. The hearings officer then reversed himself and agreed with us and proceeded forward. I bring that up because I think that's the nub of what we're talking about here. What we'd like to see happen, not from Hood River's standpoint, because the Hood River experience is over, but what we think you should be looking at is having the process be reviewed by the Department of Education to ensure that this process is taking into consideration what's best for kids in all aspects, not just the athletic aspect, and what's going to allow us in these difficult times to make sure we're not increasing costs on our school districts through this process. So what we're hopeful is that by having the Department of Education oversee and review these rules, that we'll come up with a coherent process that then we can feel good about as we proceed forward with these decisions, because I think the OSA is absolutely correct. This is going to come up again and again and again. And what we just want to feel like from our perspective is we've done everything we can to make sure in the next go-round that the other schools are treated with are faced with a system that they can understand and they can navigate through, and then at the end of the day feel like they had their say and then they move forward. Again, that's what we've done in Hood River. We're not asking at all for to be put back in that redistricting decision position again. We've moved on with where we're at, but we think that this is a problem that you can correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I?
Yes.
Okay, part of your concern was that there was not clear guidelines for reviewing your case simply because they focused on whether or not a law had been violated. Could you go through that one more
time? Yeah, thank you, Senator Starr. The question was, as we went through the process, is what was the proper standard of review for the hearings officer to look at as part of the decision that the OSAA had made. Essentially what we did is we took the decision-making process, that volume you looked at, and said we think that they didn't follow the proper criteria and they made the decision based on other issues other than cost and geography and loss of instruction time.
Okay.
The OSAA said no, they'd taken those things into account. So essentially the hearings officer was set almost as a contested case hearing and was put in the position of trying to determine whether there was enough evidence in the record to substantiate the decision that was made. Unfortunately, since, again, this had never happened before, he was left with, well, what's the proper standard of review? And as lawyers do, we fought over that. And the OSAA lawyer and I had a disagreement about that. They said only if we violated a law, and we wanted to move the standard and say, no, actually, it has to be, there has to be at least substantial evidence. Again, I think we prevailed in that argument, but it was one of those situations where we won the argument and lost the war because the hearings officer said, okay, Mr. Baker, I agree with your standard, and you still lose, which happens to me. But through that process, I think, in trying to explain to my board how this process was going and what was going to happen and what they should expect and what the avenues were for further appeal, it was unclear. And I don't think that's a fault of the OSAA. I think what we need to do, though, with this process, hopefully, is make clear what a school can do when they're faced with a decision that they disagree with regards to redistricting. Oftentimes, schools, part of this process that the OSAA goes through, they deal with the issues and they address those concerns. But what we'd like to see, again, is the Department of Education, who's charged with, you know, the education of kids, of all the kids, and educating all of them. We want to make sure that the athletic component is part of that and not separate from it.
Could I?
Yes.
Now, you've had a chance to look at the amendment to the bill.
Right.
Could you comment on that?
I think what this amendment does at this point is put in the hands of the Department of Education the obligation as part of reviewing these rules to go through a rulemaking process, hear comments on that, and engage in the dialogue with the OSAA and interested parties about what's the best way of doing this. So I think that this is a perfectly appropriate amendment to the statute, because what it does is says we're going to establish rules here that lay out how these things are to be handled in the future.
Now, could I ask just one more question?
One more question.
So what happened to Hood River? It's over. It's done. Tell me the result of this agreement.
Mr. Fisk is our principal at the high school, and he's, you know, as he would say, he's where the rubber meets the road, and he can tell us what's happened with the kids there. I'm just a lawyer in my office, so.
Well, I'm sorry. What is Hood River actually? Then they're being transferred to different.
Yes, states. They've been moved from the Mount Hood Conference to the Intermountain Conference.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Steve Fisk. I'm actually a co-principal at Hood River Valley High School. And I'm here to share just some of the things that have transpired since our move to the Intermountain Conference and its effect overall financially and with kids. As we went into the process last year with the increased travel costs to our district, an additional $33,000 has been spent and will be spent over the course of the school year in covering additional travel time, additional overnight trips for students. And what we hadn't seen was its eventual impact on involvement in sports, and we did see a 15% decline in involvement in fall sports. Not knowing that is necessarily enough, I went and talked to some of the students. Originally, one of our students, a young lady by the name of Jenny Villagomez, spoke on behalf of the student athletes at our high school, and I asked Jenny a couple of simple questions, really basic. How has it affected your studies? How has it affected really your life with sports in high school? And she commented a couple of ways. One, she said that she has to maintain a part-time job in order to help her family. She's from a migrant family and has not been involved in winter sports due to the travel difficulties, the distance and time. And second, that academically she's able, but she's not as able to give the time to her studies because of the commitment she had in the fall with the soccer program. It does have an impact. Realistically, when you looked, you couple the $33,000 in extra transportation costs along with budget reductions on top of it, it was very impacting. As far as how we feel as a high school, we've changed. We're moving on. But you have these lingering thoughts as an educator. I was in sports when I was in high school. You learn many, many life lessons in participation in sports. But it's a supplement to what we learn in school. It's in addition to, and no one light should shine necessarily brighter than the other, and sensitivity must be given to the role the classroom and the school plays in their lives. And we shouldn't force choices like this. They're difficult for kids. And we have fewer kids playing sports now. and that's not a good thing.
Thank you.
My name is Rick Dills. I'm a 25-year resident of Hood River and a 30-year educator in the state of Oregon, and I'm a school district administrator, but not for Hood River County Schools. I'm a school district administrator for Gresham-Barlow Schools. I'm speaking here today primarily as a parent, not in any way as a representative of my school district. I think that's important to say. But my perspective as a school administrator certainly influences my participation in this testimony today. Senator Starr and Senator Morissette, I'd like to just offer perspective from a few angles. One of those is as somebody who's been a teacher, a coach, a school administrator, and now a district administrator. I'm a longtime community member. Most important, I'm the parent of a 16-year-old student-athlete in Hood River, competes in basketball and baseball. And I'm a representative of all the other parents and community members, and to try to give you a sense of what I think students and parents can go through in this process, and essentially in feeling rather disenfranchised by the process. I think our hope in supporting Senate Bill 388 is that it will provide a clearer process to all that seems less arbitrary to those it most affects. I know OSAA can give you lots of evidence that will show that the process is anything but arbitrary, and I have tremendous respect for them. I've, as a coach, as somebody who's worked with kids, gone to state tournaments, the OSAA does a great job for kids in our state. They act in the interests of kids in schools. I don't doubt that in any way. However, their processes are ones which have developed over time among member organizations. And this experience in this case, I think, shows how those processes don't necessarily look at the experience from the point of view of an individual school district, and even more so its parents, its community, and its kids. And so hopefully a process where the State Board of Education and the Department of Education can represent that point of view will provide what I would call sort of a necessary check and balance to the process. In a sense, I think it can help the OSAA as much as it can help schools and school districts, and then particularly parents and students. Now, the specifics of what this can mean, just so you get a feel for what does happen to kids. Steve addressed those rather generally. From the point of view of my son, here's his succession of experiences. When he found out that Hood River was going to be moved from the Mount Hood Conference, which is a conference that Hood River has traditionally been a member of, to the IMC, he was confused. He just didn't understand why that would happen. What would be the point of that? That makes no sense at all to him. And he was disappointed to not feel that he was going to continue to compete against teams and athletes that he'd competed against for a number of years. I think he had a hard time understanding, as most kids and families did, how an organization like the OSAA acts and makes decisions, seemingly so disconnected from the experience of the athletes. This year he's competed in the IMC. He played basketball this winter. He's going to play baseball this spring. And he's resilient. And the OSAA will be glad to know that he had good experience. I asked him the other day, if you were the Senate or you were king here, would you change things around? And he said, I have to think about that, Dad. So I think kids do move on. But I don't think we want kids to go through the experience that he did. And frankly, from a parent point of view, even if he's okay with moving on, I can still see some significant changes. He has had much less time in school. Last year, the earliest he ever left for a contest was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. This year, every time he's gone to an away contest, he's left at noon. In April, he'll leave at 7:30 in the morning to go to a doubleheader in Redmond. He'll miss an entire day of school. When he's had overnight or evening contests during the week, he's gotten home past midnight with school the next day. Most of the IMC contests are on a Friday-Saturday, which means that he hasn't been able to work on a Saturday. For somebody like Jenny Villagomez, that makes all the difference in the world. For my son, we can survive. And he's had less support from family and friends in the stands. There just aren't very many parents who can make the trip. The shortest trip that we travel now is a little over 2 hours. The longest that he used to travel was about an hour. And so this experience has really changed for him and other athletes in the school. The OSAA has plenty of reasons why that's important and necessary, and they're probably valid. But in this time, I hope we're not making decisions without at least considering the impact on kids and their education, and of course the whole fiscal side of the issue. Now, I can tell you in this case, Hood River County Schools did everything they could to oppose the move. So did the Mount Hood Conference, the conference that Hood River was a member of. And my district has two high schools that are in that conference, and it's meant additional cost for our schools as well. That might seem counterintuitive, but in fact it has. The redistricting decisions have led to greater cost for our district than would have been the case if Hood River had stayed in the district. So there are impacts on many districts. I don't know about the IMC. I know they wanted Hood River, but I talked to a parent in Prineville the other day, and her comment was that the travel now, where parents have to travel to Pendleton, then down to Hood River and back to Prineville, is very difficult for parents and for kids. So I'm not sure that even the IMC schools have benefited in the way that I think the OSAA hoped they would. So we hope that not that this will be changed, but that other schools, other families, other students will at least know what the rules will be, that there'll be a balancing view when decisions are made about redistricting, and that there'll be a clearer, as Jeff said, a clearer process for appealing those decisions, and a context for the state board and the state superintendent to look at those decisions. And there wasn't much of one last year. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Appreciate Senator Morris.
Well, I guess the whole thing boils down to enrollment numbers in schools. Rural Oregon schools are declining in population, and so there has to be some shifts to maintain the districts, I guess. That's the reason for this, and it's difficult. So I guess I'm just saying that's the bottom line of the redistricting, right?
Well, I don't know if that's a question. This is not a case where enrollment was an issue in redistricting. The school stayed in the same classification with schools of the same enrollment. It was simply an issue of the OSAA deciding that it would be better for competitive balance to move two schools, Hood River and actually St. Mary's, from their existing leagues to other leagues. And it didn't have anything to do with enrollment. In fact, really, its ease of scheduling and competitive balance appear to have been the major criteria for making the decision, as opposed to the other criteria that Mr. Baker mentioned.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming in. Made a long trip to be here. We appreciate that. We have two others, Jim Keene and Paul Curtis. You understand, of course, we're now talking about the Dash 2 amendments, and I believe we've got some considered agreement on that. But please, your testimony.
Okay, I guess maybe I'll start. My name is Jim Keene. I'm superintendent of schools in Pendleton, and this is Paul Curtis, who I'll let him speak for himself in a second, as he's our director of secondary services in Pendleton. I guess for the record, I'm also a parent of three student graduates and student athlete graduates, and also a grandparent of three granddaughters. I don't know what qualification that gives me, but I feel older. Okay, and I guess I want to, and I'm speaking as a 32-year educator, and also as superintendent of Pendleton Schools for this is my fourth year. I'm speaking on behalf of the school districts in the Intermountain Conference, separate from Hood River Valley. And as you'll see, I'm presenting a written letter of testimony from from Jerry Colonna. Jerry is the superintendent at Redmond School District. And we're not trying to repeat the appeals hearing or the redistricting hearing that took place that's been discussed by previous testimony. I guess we don't intend to go through all the considerations that were made by the OSAA in the process. But I guess we have submitted for the record both Mr. Colonna's letter of testimony, and we've included also letters, pertinent letters that were submitted by the school districts of the Intermountain Conference through the process of redistricting and the appeals process. So you can get a sense that this was clearly a position of unanimity among the districts of the Intermountain Conference. And you can see that as Mr. Colonna expresses on the front page of his testimony, we believe that the OSAA has been very complete in both their process and has had a definitive process for with criteria that are the defined criteria for defining placement of schools. And we think that it's significant, as Mr. Colonna has elaborated, that the criteria are beyond the four that were initially submitted with Senate Bill 388. We think it's essential that the additional criteria that are currently included are maintained, and we feel that issues such as league balance and adequate competition for all schools and all leagues is a clear part of the process that needs to be considered. I guess I want to just bring it, if you just, I didn't bring a map, but if you picture the location of Pendleton and you think of the location of Hood River Valley, the Central Oregon schools going down to Bend, and Hermiston, for Pendleton School District, Hood River Valley is our second closest school. Coming this direction today from Pendleton, we drove past the turnoff to Hermiston, and then the next 4A high school that we arrived at was Hood River Valley. And we arrived there quite a bit faster than we would have by heading down south at Biggs Junction, heading down towards Redmond or the three schools in Bend or down to Crook County. We say that it was beyond an open invitation for another school to join our league. It was essential that we maintain balance with the other leagues in the state. And in fact, the Intermountain Conference, even with the presence of Hood River Valley, we're still the smallest of the conferences in the state. So it's essential for us to maintain adequate competition for our student athletes in our league. And we understand the costs of distance. For Pendleton School District, our distances are furthest of all the schools in the league because we don't have that many close neighbors, and so we end up with the furthest travel. It's over 100 miles round trip further for us to go to Bend than it is for Hood River Valley, and this comes across as us against Hood River Valley. I guess I don't want it to come across that way. What we want to speak for is the fairness of the process, of the OSAA process, and what we feel is a process that looks at the student athletes in all 297 member schools. We think it's essential to maintain that. Now, we do feel that with this amendment, with the amendment that has been established that takes a review, I think there's been some misstatement earlier. It's as we understand it, through the State Board of Education, that the review through the State Board of the criteria is defendable, and we support the amendment. But we had major reservation, and that's why we signed in opposition to Senate Bill 388 as it was initially submitted.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Curtis. I'm Assistant Superintendent of Pendleton School District. I've been in Eastern Oregon and went through these various reclassifications every 4 years since 1978. I do believe that the criteria that was suggested in the original bill dealing with minimizing loss of instructional time, costs, and student travel time have affected Pendleton School District in our 4A division more than almost any other one in the United in this state. I think the issue is it has not been restrictive of a student turnout or parental participation over that time period. It's a matter of getting used to the situation where you live and to deal with it. We need to have some kind of an organization here that in ORS 339-430 that mentions basically that there is a process of appeal, and I think that's sufficient. Thereby, we did not support the content of Senate Bill 388. We didn't see the waiver or the amendment until we got here, but I think the amendment is good. But at the same time, the OSAA has to manage the activities in the state, and they do a good job with it. And they have continued to exercise a reasonable process in dealing with the reorganization every 4 years. That's, I think, on record, and it should be. But for us to micromanage through the legislature or through the state board, anything else is not proper. It's only proper from the standpoint of having a process that's clear. And I think it was very clear and has been clear for a long period of time. This is basically a one school district continued appeal through all the sets of appeals, and they didn't like the result. Now, we like having Hood River in our league, and we support them, and we will continue to work in that fashion. If we didn't like what happened in OSAA, we'd go through the same appeals. But at the same time, we live with the result, and that's the advent of our testimony. Thank goodness that there are amendments that apparently can be agreed upon and need to be agreed upon, but at the same time, we need to realize that in the best interest of kids, OSAA is providing those contexts every 4 years. So we support their efforts and did not support Senate Bill at 388. So with the amendment, we think that there is some possibility of further clarification, and certainly there's always that avenue of appeal. And in the long run, the organization will probably be better off as a consequence.
Thank you very much. Question? I believe our questions have been answered. Appreciate you traveling all this way. Sorry that we didn't have the information to provide you before you set out on this trip.
Well, thank you, thank Senator you. Starr.
Beautiful day for traveling.
You bet.
Right, we're going to. Anyone else care to testify on the bill? If not, we're going to close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 388. The chair is open for a motion to amend.
I move to amend with the dash two amendments, amend 380, Senate Bill 388.
Senator Morris.
389.
No, 388.
Okay, I've got too many things. 388, thank you.
Senator Morissette has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 388. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay, well, I would move Senate Bill 388 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette has moved Senate Bill 388 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Perry.
Aye.
Senator
Morissette.
Aye. Vice Chair
Decker. Chair Starr. Aye. I received the necessary votes. Senate Bill 388 passed the floor, and we will allow Senator Metzger to
very
carry
good.
That bill for
very
us.
Good.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 282. And Senator Beyer, would you come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. Before you have currently Senate Bill 282, we also have another bill, 283. I guess we'll do one right after that. I know there are people in the audience who are anxious to talk about Senate Bill 283. Senate Bill 282 is a bill that would direct school districts to admit non-resident students ages 5 through 19 who attend grades 9 to 12 if space is available. Under current law, a school district or a parent, if they want to have their students go to a different school than where they live, they have to first go to the school board where they live and get that school board to release the students. And then they have to go to the school board where they want the students to go, and that school board has to accept the students. For this, and that has to happen for the money from the state school support fund to follow the school. And that is the issue at this point in time, because a parent can tuition a student into another school if they so choose. But when that happens, the state school support fund actually kind of ends up in limbo, because the school where the student leaves doesn't get the state school support fund anymore, and the school where the student goes to doesn't get the state school support fund. So what this bill does is says if there's space available in a district, in a school, and the parents so choose, then the money follows the child, is basically what it comes down to. This is important, and actually just after I introduced this bill, it was brought to my attention just in the last couple of days at Jervis School District, which is not in my, well, the school is not in my district, but many of the residents in my district go to Jervis School, has just announced that they are no longer going to release students from their school to go to other schools. And in rural areas, and Jervis is a good example, I had a call this morning from a constituent who lives 3 miles from Mount Angel, 9 miles from Jervis. All their activity is associated with Mount Angel. That's where they grew up. They go to church. They do their business there, everything else. But their kids have to go to Jervis School, and Jervis has announced they are no longer going to release any students from their district for any reason. So you've got a case where a family wants to put their students in a different school, but the schools won't allow that to happen, and these people cannot afford to tuition their students into the other district. I think this is important. I think it's an issue of choice and competition, quite frankly. This is a way to get students, or to get schools, to have to compete for the students, and I think that will lead to a better quality of education in Oregon. Because let's face it, there's not many students who are going to be moving around the state of Oregon, because this bill, and I'll have to apologize, I have to look back and make sure the bill was drafted the last time I spoke to this bill, which was 2 years ago, or maybe even 4 years ago now, I don't remember. This bill does not provide for busing or transportation of students, and I think you'll see in Section 3 of the bill that is still the case. The students in the district would be eligible for busing if they get the student to a bus stop on a regular bus route of the school they want to go to. But it does not require a school such as in Beaverton to go to Molalla and pick up a child. If a parent gets the school their child to a bus route in Beaverton, Beaverton School, would then be eligible for transportation funding for that child for the length of the route, of their normal route. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions about this. I think it's a concept we need. It's long overdue in the state of Oregon, and I believe that it would just help to make Oregon schools better.
Questions?
I just have one.
Senator Byrne. Yes,
thank
Senator Deckard.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and esteemed Senator, I guess the natural question that I have, so I'm thinking especially in today's world where you have this, and I'm thinking obviously the metro area where you have what's going on in Portland and, you know, the days that are being cut, and would you see just some real changes happening just this school year? Because there's just high anxiety. I'm sure it's statewide. I know, you know, my neck of the woods, we always know better than other places, but I'm sure this anxiety is just statewide and it's entrenched. I'm wondering if you just see, I think there might be a lot of kids that would just, and parents that would start really this year trying to even get out for spring term and get into some of the suburban school districts. We know next year that's going to be a big problem everywhere. But even for this year, I don't know, that's just the immediate thought that I had, that there could be a lot of students that would do that within the next 3 or 4 months if the statute was on the books, say, 2 years ago.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, yeah, feasibly that could happen. I think it's important that we have put in this bill with space available. Space would obviously go to in-district residents first, and if there is space available and beyond that. And speaking specifically to Beaverton schools and Hillsborough schools, I've been hearing for my time in the legislature that you guys can't build schools out there fast enough to house the people who live there. Mm-hmm. So I think that in itself would prohibit a mass influx of residents from the Portland area into the Beaverton area, for example, mm-hmm. because we do have that in the bill, the space available issue.
Thank you very much. And our sign up. We will
Mr. Chair,
allow you.
Pleasure. You can either finish this one or start the next one.
I think that we will, in order to allow you to conserve your time, we're going to close the. Or recess the hearing on 282 and open the hearing on 283 so that you can present that to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. Senate Bill 283 is a slightly different bill than the last one. Actually, it's quite a bit different, but it's somewhat on a similar subject of schools. This bill sets in place the process so that school districts could divide into smaller units. Senator Morissette may remember this bill from a few years ago. I probably won't speak about that now, but anyway. what this bill does, currently in statute, we have a process for school districts to combine and to become larger, for two school districts to become one, three school districts to become one. You name it. What this bill does is sets in statute the process so that if a single school district wants to divide into smaller districts or multiple districts, it would set the process for how that would happen. And again, I'll look at Portland School District. Senator Deckert just spoke of that. We've got a very large district there. Maybe it would be more efficient for that district to be run as two separate districts or perhaps even three separate districts. I don't know. But if the people in the local area decide that's the way it should be, I think the process should be in place to allow that to happen. In my time in the legislature, and at least the three senators on my left were all here as long as I have been here or longer, we have passed a bill, I believe it was in the 97, possibly the 99 session, that allowed a single school district was split into two in Columbia County. I don't remember if that was in 99 or 97. We also have, and I think it might be on your agenda today, another bill to allow a single school district in Eastern Oregon to split into two school districts. So the process we have now in Oregon is if the residents of an area want to split their school into smaller units or their district into smaller units, they've got to come to the legislature and have us debate it and decide if that's what should be done. That's about as unlocal a control as you can have. This bill is not mandating anything on anyone. All it does is says if the residents of an area decide they want to do it, there is a process in place for how it will be done. It's as simple as that. You have other people here in the audience today from Lincoln County who are wishing that this bill was in effect right now because they have an area that they don't have a bill of their own in the legislature. But you've got the area, the people in Lincoln County seem to be in agreement that it's time to split Lincoln County schools into smaller units because it's not working the way it is. But there is not a process for them to be able to do that. And short of introducing a bill to come to the legislature and have us do it for them. So that's what this bill does. With that, I will stop my testimony so you can get on to the people behind me who have traveled some very great distance. And obviously they're very busy because I'm trying to call them right now.
may I ask?
Yes.
Senator Beyer, this, excuse my ignorance, and I haven't seen it in the bill, but are we talking about a K-12 district? There'll be a K-12 in each of the districts that would split? Is that what we're... Because I know we went through unification that said that you should have a continuum, and you're not reversing that by this, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, This bill does not adjust the statute in law that says all school districts will be K through 12 districts. That's not addressed by this.
Thank you.
That's a different issue we could address if we wanted to.
Any further questions of the witness?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. With that, we're going to go to our public hearing on Senate Bill 282, and we will invite up. Oh, let's have. Got Chuck Bennett, Pat Gill-Sullivan, John Marshall come up together.
Oh boy, the school establishment. Yeah, tell mine.
Yes, that's it. Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Regarding Senate Bill 282, we are opposed to the bill. I've provided you with a copy of an article that appeared in this morning's Statesman Journal to help you understand the situation in Jervis as described by the bill sponsor, so you can kind of at least get an idea of what the issues are in Jervis and what kind of is going on out there. There are just a number of issues in this bill, and I just kind of want to go through it with you to see if you want to take a further look at least at its drafting, if not at the substance of it, and I know my colleagues will also speak to the substance of it. Mr. Chairman, you go down to on page 1, line 12, through 18, any non-resident person between the ages of 5 and 19 who applies to the district school board for admission based on academic reason to attend grades 9 through 12. And there's just a problem assuming 5-year-olds are applying to attend grades 9 through 12. It's just, there is a non sequitur here that we think at least ought to be corrected in this. It bases this solely on the question for the receiving school district as to whether it has space available. The bill goes on and deals with issues involving special education, which just frankly we found somewhat confusing, particularly when you get to the question of who pays, who writes the contract, and who develops the IEP for this special education student. Do you have a contracting school district setting a cost for a school district where a student has left? And we could see that we think there are. This is rife with problems and ones that we'd sure want to explore with you more closely. You go down then to line 31 on page 1, and we're now seeing, and I think this is one that concerns us as well, a district school board must admit. This takes this issue from my currently administrative procedure and puts it into the school board's hand, into a policy matter, which again just changes the entire complexion of who decides relative to students arriving and leaving. This has traditionally been a on individual cases, it has been handled by administrative action. So, Ms. Chairman, for that and other reasons, we think at least the bill needs to be worked substantially, but I'll leave it to my colleagues to talk to some of the policy issues associated with it as well. And I hope you'll also take a look at the article regarding what is happening in a large rural district like Jervis that touches on a number of larger school districts like Kaiser and Silverton, larger in, at least in relation to Jervis, where you do have students at the periphery of the district starting to move out and the impact that has on a district like Jervis. And I think the subhead in this certainly points to the kind of problem that can at least exist or existed in this headline writer's opinion as to whether or not this is as a result of changing demographics in the district rather than any kind of educational policy. And I think those are other kinds of issues that at least we all ought to be sensitive to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. The fundamental question, I think, is should a student be able to attend a public school other than his or her neighborhood school? And I think we'd all come up with an answer that's probably yes, for a variety of reasons. Some research on choice within the public school system suggests that students go to schools other than their neighborhood school primarily for the reason of parental convenience. It's not for academic reasons. It's not that a boyfriend or girlfriend went to another school. It's because the parents work someplace and it's more convenient for them to drop a student off. Many school districts in Oregon already have choice opportunities available to students that reside within the school district, that is, going to another school within the school district. The question you face here is what kind of procedure should be in place to allow a student to attend a school in another school district. And we currently have in law an administrative rule, a process which allows that to occur. And it requires agreement between the sending district and the receiving district. Much of that is based on space. Much of that's based on the kinds of programs the student's seeking, the reasons for the transfer, be it parental convenience, be it for academic reasons, or they want to move because the other school district has a better football team, etc. The point is that there are procedures in place that allow for local consideration of how that process will occur. We have a system of funding schools in Oregon that may not be the best in the world, but the one we have, and it funds schools based on the number of students. You don't have to read the paper very long to realize we have a significant school funding problem in the state. And so many of the decisions that are made relative to students moving from one school district to another have to do with funding. The sending school district doesn't want to lose students because they lose dollars. The receiving school district doesn't want to get more students because they have capacity issues or they have programmatical issues. And as I think, as you see in the decision with Jervis, there may be issues there beyond funding or program that are at play. The point is we have a procedure in place. It allows local consideration to look at students' circumstances on a case-by-case basis, and we believe that works well, and we ought to leave it alone.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Patty O'Sullivan.
Excuse me, we got a question.
Oh, sorry.
Senator. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Mr. Arioli, thank you.
I think that Mr. Marshall explains well the ideal circumstance. But I wish that I could hear him also address what happens when you've got a district that makes a policy decision not to consider the case-by-case appeals that are made, that they just adopt a blanket policy. And doesn't that, in fact, force reconsideration of a policy that reasonable people make work until somebody decides not to be reasonable and not to look at the case-by-case situation? And isn't that what we have in the bill before us? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, I think the if you're speaking specifically to the Jervis situation, I think obviously based on the article, and I don't have any other knowledge of that circumstance, it would appear that a decision was made to try to protect the educational program of the students in that school district, and not and the board made a conscious decision not to allow a mass exodus that would have a dramatic impact on the students that were left. And I think that's a decision that they made. We can perhaps second guess whether that was an appropriate decision, but I would submit that they might have had a little bit more information that I certainly have at my disposal to make a judgment about that decision.
Senator Decker.
Kind of brings up a question that, and this, you know, for me, 6 years ago, I remember the notion of public school choice, which is a pretty enticing idea. And I remember a conversation I had with our then Secretary of State about what would happen if we just really opened up the boundaries of the state, and it really has never taken hold here. But this bill at least contains elements of that, which would mean how is that effective, allowing public school and parents to be the consumers and kind of shop around for their best school? And I don't know the practicalities of how it would work out, but I'd be interested, particularly with this bill before us, what this panel thinks of at least that idea of allowing choice amongst parents and their child attending school.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckard, we now have a structure whereby annually parents receive report cards that are based on some subjective judgment that ranks school districts as either high-performing or poor, essentially. And I would hate to think that that would, if we did have a system of statewide school choice, for lack of a better term, that you would all of a sudden see a mass exodus away from the schools that needed additional assistance. There are obviously circumstances whereby some students, based on the mobility of their parents or financial resources, are able to go to another school, any place they want to go, and there's some that would be left. And I would hate to think, given the way we fund schools, that this mass exodus of students and the mass exodus of resources away from some schools and leaving those schools in poor circumstances to get poorer. I think that would be a travesty. And so I think the question is, how do you balance between giving students and their parents options while recognizing that when students leave, the dollars leave with them, and therefore it creates a financial strain on the schools and the kids that are left? How do you strike a balance? And I think the only way to do that is to allow local boards to make that decision based on their own unique circumstances. And unfortunately, some will maybe make choices that many of us might judge for the wrong reasons.
Senator Morissette.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a follow-up on Senator Ferriero's question. Have school districts consistently refused to allow a person to transfer out of their district in the past without making the hard and fast rule that in no way are we going to let someone transfer out? I mean, the Jervis School Board, by saying under any circumstance, I think raises a real red flag. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question is, it seems to me school districts could make that same kind of decision without raising that flag simply by denying. Now, have school districts done that in the past?
Senator Morissette, I don't have all the information on inter-district transfers at my disposal. I know the Department of Education keeps track of those inter-district transfers where there's an agreement between both boards, because they have to have data on hand to know where to send the state money in terms of which school district could legitimately claim a student for resident purposes. But I'm not aware of any kind of other blanket kinds of decisions other than what I saw in this news article.
Okay. Well, and I don't know if there's anybody here from the Jervis School District to defend that. My personal philosophy is that there needs to be some inter-district communication. You know, I think districts have to work together. I guess I am concerned that they... And I don't, without someone here from Jervis to testify, I don't know what their rationale is, but it just seems to be that they would have another way of achieving that end without the blanket statement, and that way this bill wouldn't even be here.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore said, ideally, I think you describe exactly how it has been working, but I think you also would agree that the fairly chaotic condition of school funding at this time is part of what results in this kind of action by a local school board trying to protect its base program. And I think we can all, and we certainly will, make contact with Jervis and provide you with information regarding their decision-making process. But responsibility is shared for the problems that school districts like Jervis have right now. And five special sessions and the sixth one now is not helping matters for districts that are facing these kinds of financial problems. And the kinds of responses that occur are not always what we would consider to be best practices or best public policy, but it's their best decision for the school district given the situation that we all have handed them through unstable school funding at the state level.
Well, ma'am. My advice to them is never say never.
Yeah, that's always a good rule, sir.
Senator Ferriero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we've been nibbling around at the edges of this issue for a while. In grading some of the schools in our system, we've actually found some of them to be substandard and allowed
students in those schools to leave. We've seen the rise of homeschooling till it's a significant portion of students in our education system. And I think most of the private schools in Oregon are flourishing at this point in time. So I guess the question that occurs to me is that I have critics who suggest that what we do when we limit options for parents and students is to protect mediocrity. And that's a very harsh indictment against the system that I don't subscribe to. I don't think it's mediocre. But in those cases where people need to leave for whatever reason or want to leave, we seem to be sort of flying in the face of the demand for people to have change and to be in control. So I guess what I'm asking is, how do I answer critics to our system when they see us doing what is described by them as being protecting mediocrity in our system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, I hope you would not move from the exception of Jervis to create a rule statewide. I think Mr. Marshall described accurately what the general situation is, which is a substantial flexibility in the districts regarding their ability to arrive at choice either in district or across district lines. So certainly can understand how you would arrive at a critical position relative to what we have in the local paper regarding Jervis, but to go from any further than that, I think we'd all probably better take a closer look at what's going on broadly. If in fact there is a flourishing private school system and homeschooling is on the growth and all the rest of that, I think that's a, I think we can all have a discussion on that.
Mr. Chairman, and I'd welcome that discussion. I think, you know, after a couple of seasons on the Education Committee, we hear a lot of that. And I do think that the homeschool system is flourishing, and I know that private schools aren't having any trouble keeping open. But I also know that we've got some real problems academically in certain schools in Oregon. And the best way to get attention for that is to focus attention on that. And for too long, in some cases, we've been able to simply say that's a local problem. But now that there are benchmarks and testing and feedback and even stronger federal mandates, we can see that failed schools are a problem not only just for that local community, but the whole system. But I don't know how you get to the place where we see those issues rise to a level that they get dealt with on a policy basis, unless they become a crisis. And we got a lot of schools out there. They're all competing for our attention. I don't mean to suggest that Gervais is a problem district. I'm just saying that as long as people are willing to look at a case-by-case basis, and let the cases be decided on their merits, they ought to be decided at the local level, absolutely, unquestionably. But if there's people out there who just decide on a public policy that for reasons of diversity, which is a theme in the Gervais issue, or simply reasons of financial stability for the district, they're just not going to hear it. Is there an appeal process? Do they get to go to a higher authority if the district says no? Are they just stuck? And then do we force these people to make the choice to go to homeschool or a private school if they just feel stuck? That's the question. Is there an answer? It's not rhetorical, Mr.
Chairman. Oh, yes. Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, let me let the air out of that question. Is there an appeal process if people get told by the school district that they're not even going to consider transfers?
I'm not aware that there's any statutory appeals process.
Okay.
That was your question.
That was the question. Yeah. It was embedded in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I noticed the name of an old friend of mine. Who's the Superintendent Bruce Anderson that I crossed paths with in Prineville the first time.
We
remember Senate Bill 880, which came from that association there. I just wonder if there's a pattern here.
I first met Mr. Anderson when he was in Tillamook.
All righty.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Dexter.
I just want to make sure Patty does not get to testify. I think, are doing our best to ensure that. I will just make one brief comment, and it's not a question. It's the one thing that we're not mentioning with all of this, which I, to me at least, what I've heard more is funding. That given the last decade and the state's experiment with Measure 5 and state funding of schools, if there is a one cry out that I have heard, and this has been somewhat statewide, it has been, I would like to see schools funded, and then we will, and I think we're hearing that in the spring especially, and that's been the main reason. And so to me, to look at this absent of funding is a half a conversation.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Deckard, I couldn't agree more, and I think a lot of the bills that you have seen and will see are symptoms of a larger problem, that they wouldn't be here if schools were adequately funded and offering students the kinds of programs and opportunities they ought to have and not force them to seek out moving to other districts or move to homeschool or private school or having districts break off or create new districts out of existing districts or break up existing districts.
Senator Farioli.
Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with anything that our good vice chairman just said, but adequacy is in the eye of the beholder. And I've sat and watched the legislature struggle with 13 and 14 and 15% funding increases for education every session for three sessions, and heard the press talk about 13.5% increases as a cut to school funding. And then now we've got, we spent a lot of energy doing the quality education model, which we'll never catch. At least, I don't see how. Please, and so the question of adequacy is certainly a matter of how adequate and by whose definition adequate. I don't mean to be argumentative, but adequacy and funding is part of the issue, but it's not the whole issue here. This is an issue about choice and about parental control and about responsiveness by the district to individual patrons. That's what this is about. This ain't about the macro issue. This is about people getting respect from the district folks that have their own reasons for saying no.
Let's go on. And
sure.
Yeah, please.
Patty O'Sullivan, Portland Public Schools. At the risk of not getting out while the getting's good, I'll explain our system to you. First of all, we're a very large district, as you know, and we have 10 what we call regular high schools and many alternative schools. But we have we allow very generous in-district transfer opportunities at all levels. Any child can pretty much go to any school they want as long as there's room, and currently we just have a couple of schools that don't have room. We also have a lot of magnet programs that to entice kids to move around so that we have more diversity around the district, so that there's a special program maybe over in this school and more kids from this side of town will go over there. Those opportunities, of course, are diminishing with our diminishing dollars, but right now that's our system. As for our transfer in and out of the district, we have sort of a combination in that we allow people to the opportunity to submit an application to transfer out. We look at those based on a needs basis. If the babysitter is next to the mom's work or the dad's work and they need to bring the child there, or grandma babysits and lives across town or out of the district, whatever. There's a lot of different reasons people want to transfer out, but we look at them on a needs basis. But we do have an overall policy, unless it's considered a real needs case, that we don't allow our children to transfer out of the district unless we have an even amount sort of transferring in. It's sort of a balance. So, and I'll give you an example, not that anybody wants to talk about Riverdale again, but we do have a number of kids that go to Riverdale, but a number of Riverdale kids go to our schools, and that's a balance of some kids not fitting in very well at a large school and some kids not liking small schools. They'd rather go to a big school, big athletic teams, choir, whatever it may be. But we balance that so that the same amount come in as go out. Then we don't get into the funding issue. But if we just rampantly let people leave the district, or we don't mind if they come in, they can come in all they want and bring their money, but we don't want them leaving with their money. So Different parts of the city have kind of different, unique sets of situations. The east part of the district, we get a lot of kids over the boundaries because the schools on the other side of the boundaries are full, and their districts would rather go ahead and let some kids come in than worry about building another school. But then other parts of our school district aren't like that. So it's we're large, we're unique, but I just wanted you to know how we handle it. We do have a policy, but we have parameters within that policy and criteria that we do allow transfers. We have them transferring in, we have them transferring out for various reasons.
Thank you very much. Been very helpful. Appreciate it. We have three more people signed up. Don Hansen Lane County. Okay, I didn't see a county there. Okay. Brian Reeder from the Department of Ed, and we got another chair up here. How about Doug Morgan coming on up? Don.
You said that.
Thank you, Senator Starr, Morissette, Deckert, and Ferrioli. My name is Don Hansen. I'm a farmer from down in Cresswell. My youngest child attends Western, so I have no kids currently in public schools. I was on the Cresswell School Board for 9 years. Prior to that, I served on every committee that there was in the district. Children of the state need this bill. These transfers are between a willing district and a student who is compelled to leave for some reason, using state funds, not district dollars. Emphasis on state funds. The benefits to education of a student who transfers are many, and there are basically no negative impacts on a student who transfers. Why isn't this bill a win-win? A willing district, a happy student, and state dollars. It's the greed of the school districts, who view the state money as their money, who view the loss of any students as increased layoffs. 16 students is one teacher in their mind. With this thinking, a district of 2,000 students is better than one.
Gentlemen, please.
With this thinking, a district of 2,000 students is better than one with 1,900 students. In your legislative districts, who are your best schools? It isn't the size that makes a good school. At an OSBA meeting in Portland one year, a speaker said that change only occurs in bad times. We are definitely in bad times, but the education community is refusing to change. They are fearful of change. The Eugene School District has an open transfer policy among its four main high schools. A little over 4 years ago, Churchill was down to 700 students. Students were transferring out. Churchill made some changes, and are now over 1,700 students. Those to OEA and OSBA will be testifying, I talked about this before they got up here, about the last loss of funds. Only students who can transfer will. The easiest to teach will be the first to go, etc. All of the negatives. If someone transfers, then some district gains. Why are all these districts worried that they are the worst ones than all the rest? Most aren't. The ones who are bad do need to change. In my years of contract negotiations on school board, it isn't what people are saying. It is what they really mean when they talk, and that applies to lobbyists. Listen between the lines to them. In February 22nd, 2003, Rich Lagarde, there's an article about Eugene superintendents rejecting Peace Academy, a new charter school, because of, quote, negative financial impacts, unquote. The two existing charter schools, again, quote, have already taken a toll on neighborhood schools by luring away students and the state funds to follow them, unquote. The need doesn't matter. The positive impact on the students who need a different alternative doesn't matter. Only the impact on their dollars matters. When is state funds for public education their dollars and not the dollars of the citizens who paid the taxes to fund it? What's best for the child is not an education mantra, but it can be yours. Do what's best for the children of the state. Force the districts that refuse a change to come aboard. Listen to what lobbyists are really saying and return the state's dollars to the taxpayers. Pass this bill on. And I added on some other stuff since then. John Marshall said that one of his statements was transfer for athletics was the reason he was against it. OSBA school boards do not do anything for, I mean, do not do anything for athletics. That's an OSAA matter, and you have to appeal OSAA committees if you want to transfer for athletic reasons. It's in their guidelines. School boards have nothing to do with it. Receiving districts have overcrowding, and there's another testimony here. Well, they have the choice to take them. If they have overcrowding, they don't have to take anybody. Existing transfer programs works. I can tell them it doesn't work at all. Down in the Eugene area, when I got the school board in 99, we had a policy where we did allow some transfers between the three smaller districts down there, pulling Pleasant Hill, Crestwell, and Cottage Grove. The Crestwell went to a no more transfer policy. All the rest of the districts now are in Eugene, Springfield, and Bethel are on a net even transfer basis. Once in a while they go one above or two above as a special needs, but very seldom it ever happens. It just doesn't work. Another question that was raised was it was the one that Morris had asked about, didn't the district's transfers, and they haven't done it. Fairly asked about homeschooling. There's a lot of kids in homeschooling. An issue in Crestwell, we passed a bond about 5 years ago, was all of new houses being built, and we needed a whole lot more school space. We passed a huge bond. Been over 400 or 500 homes built, an increase of only about 80 kids. The same social economic district as Bethel School District, which has the same type of homes going in, same type of people, the whole works, they get an average of 1.6 kids per house. Where's those 600-700 kids at? They're not there. They're going someplace else. When I got the school board, right at that time, I asked the school board, the most critical problem you have is, why are the kids going? Why are these schools, all the stuff that we should have a whole lot more students here, and they're not here. They're going someplace else. And I really think, if you really look in the homeschooling, it's a huge problem in the state. A lot of them are not being reported. They're supposed to be reported to the lane, like the ESD districts. They're not being reported. It's an area that you really, really need to be looked into. And another one that Senator Deckard talked was about the funding problem. This is not a funding problem. There's not one net dollar difference. It's going to District A or District B. It doesn't have anything to do with any funding problem. It is, the main problem is that the districts feel it's their money, and it's not their money. It's the state's money. It was the district's money when originally, before Measure 5, that all the tax dollars raised basically by the district through property taxes. Now that it isn't, all the additional students, if you add 5 more students to your district, you get 5 times X dollars from the state. It has nothing to do with the local property tax or anything else. And that's just, my comments. So, any questions, I'll take them.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Brian Reeder from the Department of Education. The department is not taking a position on this bill, but I did want to bring to your attention what may be a potential problem, a concern the department has with the bill's language regarding space available. Currently in Oregon, school buildings do not have official capacities on them, so the notion of space available is in many ways an objective one. And our concern is that districts in an open enrollment situation may use that as a way to pick and choose which students they let in. In a sense, recruiting the types of students they want and turning away the ones they don't want. I hope this is not a problem, but it is a concern that comes to mind when we look at the language where there's no definition of space available.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Can there be a definition of space available?
Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, I think there can be. It may not be a terribly straightforward thing to do. I think the way to do that is to define the capacity of each school, and then if that school is serving fewer than that number of students, then they have space available. The question of defining capacity, I don't know how easy that is to do. It's not an entirely objective measure, so there may be some problems with doing that, but there probably are ways of doing it, yes.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, my name is Doug Morgan. I am vice chair of the Silver Falls School District 4J, and wasn't prepared to speak today, but I wanted to hopefully bring some clarification to you, as we are one of the main districts that is affected by the Jervis decision. In listening to some of the testimony, I wanted to just let you know that the students that are affected by that decision, we're not talking about a mass exodus from the Jervis School District. We're talking about students that were already gone from that school district. We're talking about students that were already in other school districts. And they made a decision to eliminate that, to not allow those students to go to other school districts that are on their borders. So in other words, we're not talking about somebody from Eugene going to Salem-Keizer School District. We're talking about a school district that's right beside the school district they're going to in most cases. Because according to this bill, it even still states that transportation is not going to be provided, that the parents are still going to have to get them to that district or to a bus stop where normal routes run. So you're talking about people that are on the edges, that are on the fringes, and that's what you're seeing in this case. You're seeing where you have students and you have parents who really desire. I mean, I'm telling you, I'm the one that gets the phone calls. I'm the one that gets, that talks to the people in the stores or wherever I meet them that say, what can we do? You know, this is a situation we really want to keep our kids in your school district. We're a high-performing school district because we've done things the right way. We spent funds the right way. We think we've done things very well. I'm not saying that Jervis hasn't. I'm just saying that these parents believe in our school district, and now they are robbed of the opportunity to keep their kids in our school district. And so I'm saying that this bill right here helps in allowing for that school choice. It allows those kids to stay in our school district, and it doesn't affect the rest of our kids in our own school district, because those funds are now, because of the decision that we had nothing to do with, is now going to be leaving our district because those students can no longer be a part of our district. Some of the figures that we've heard some of the rosy predictions of those students in that situation, in this Jervis situation, are that maybe only 50% of those students are there that the Jervis district is going to see. Those other 50% probably homeschool in that situation. I mean, those are kids that are out of the system entirely. And so in conclusion, I just wanted to hopefully bring some clarification. If you have any questions on that situation, maybe I can help. But it's just a simple matter of choice and being able to actually send your kid to a district where they feel that they're going to be best served.
I have not read this article, and it's a different twist than what I had. What you're testifying to is different than what I supposed was happening. I thought that they closed the door to future transfers. You're saying that transfers already approved, or the funding has already been moved from Jervis District to your district. They're now saying, they want those students back, and they want the money.
With the one exception, they did in the Jervis situation, they did put in a grandfather clause of the high school children from 9, so basically a four-year window, from 9 to 12, grades 9 through 12. They have said that those that are in the high school there can continue through the high school, but no more transfers. Only the ones that have already been given the okay that are in those grades, K-8, you're automatically gone and you're within the Jervis school district.
Senator Decker.
Mr. Chair, how many would that in the K through 8? I mean, I know it might be a ballpark figure for you, mm-hmm. but how many families would be affected if
right.
retroactively?
Right. I anticipated this question, and I apologize. I don't have exact numbers because, again, I wasn't prepared to speak today. But right now we're trying to tabulate that, and it looks like at this point we're looking at least 25 children. And many of those children all come from the same school. So, and we fund very much similar to the way you fund us. We basically say how many children are in your school, and then this is how much money you get per child, and we try to bring it down as local control as possible, sending the money directly to that school. And so that those schools, particularly that one in this case Central Howell, is going to be extremely affected by this decision. Maybe a closure or whatever, we don't know yet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think it's obvious to me that we are don't have a bill that we can move without some further.
I would hope we would have someone from here at the school district come.
Some further input on the issue. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 282 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 283. And looks like they were only for hearings today anyway.
Had a little wiggle room there.
Yeah, these but two. This bill was only for public hearing. Now, 283, we have Chuck Bennett again. We have we're going to hear you from Chuck, and then we're going to Brian Reeder, would you come on up, and we'll have you follow Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, we testified extensively, I think, on kind of the philosophy of this idea on a previous bill dealing with the breakup out in Morrow County District, I think just sort of philosophically. But I just want to point to, and I think you understand we're opposed to this, just to give you kind of a very quick general construct as to why. In 1991, the legislature mandated consolidation of districts. We created a third fewer districts in this state. It resulted, you believed, as your predecessors, in a coordinated curriculum, fewer school districts, fewer administrators, it resulted in just a general set of efficiencies in school districts. In fact, this philosophy continues to be so commonly held in the legislature, I expect to see bills that will limit the number of school districts to 36 when we start hearing about county school districts as members begin introducing those bills. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, again, this bill relates, we believe, to the funding issue. We don't believe this is the time to start reconfiguring school district in this state to create smaller districts. That just doesn't make sense at this point. In fact, Mr. Chairman, you will see, I'm sure, throughout this session, as you did last session, small districts coming to the legislature saying we're having a hard time making it because we are so small or we are so remote, but most commonly we are so small and we have these unusual costs. You need to provide additional funds to us per student in order to keep our district alive. And, Mr. Chairman, just quite simply, that is not the direction we believe the configuration of the district should be going at this point. When you do fund the quality education model and you do start looking at schools of the size outlined in the QEM, perhaps we can start talking about high schools of 500 and ideal-sized elementary schools and all of the rest of it and take a new look at the configuration of the school districts. But to go back on the direction you sent us all in 1991 seems an errand we'd not choose to join you in. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Senator Ferriero.
Mr. Chairman, there's an axiom that floats around this building from time to time, and that is that you cannot bind future legislatures to an action or to refrain from an action. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate the idea that we ordered this consolidation. It wasn't so much ordered as it was suffered by many of the districts that were forced to be consolidated.
We all suffered, yeah.
It was tough. Mine wasn't even here. I was outside the building, and I knew how tough it was.
Yeah.
But that argument flies in the face of the axiom that you can't bind a future legislature. From time to time, things change.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, now's not the time for the change, and that's our argument. We're not saying you're bound by anything, except please accept the good advice. Stay bound by that decision and don't head backwards on that one. We think that's good advice.
Mr. Chairman, follow up?
Yes.
That advice track to the adjustments to the funding formulas and some of the other controversial issues, the ESD consolidations?
Mr. Chairman, we're not asking for changes in funding formulas, nor is it on the table today, but we are not asking for changes in funding formulas or any of the rest of it at this point. We'll be glad to, in other committees, be addressing those issues as well.
Okay. Stay the course may be good advice.
May I ask you just a very quick question? The Unified School District was part of that action, was it not, to make sure that there was a...
Mr. Chairman, I apologize, Senator Morissette. I just don't know.
Okay. Well, I can understand a Unified School District of making sure you have elementary K through 12.
It was.
But I don't know that I have a problem with reorganizing a district that allows a K through 12 to become its own district. I don't know. I oppose that. I mean, but I wouldn't want to go beyond that. So I guess I have an open mind on this.
I comment and maybe a question attached to it. I think that we're seeing a revolution in the way education is delivered today. There are students in our public education system being underserved, primarily on both ends of the bell curve. These students that are being well served are the ones that are in the center of the bell curve. And those that are leaving school are not those in the center of the bell curve. Primarily those leaving school are the ones on the bottom of the bell curve. And there are programs now available to reach those students. And Portland's doing it through magnet schools, and other districts are doing it in other ways. But we had testimony last week about a charter school that had 23 sites, and they were primarily chartered to reach the children that were dropping out of school. I think that and the question I pose is, isn't perhaps charter schools a way of getting at the issue of meeting the needs of students within districts that might want to opt out of the district that they're presently engaged with?
Mr. Chairman, certainly that has been one of the choices that has been developed in Oregon and has been a really, I think, successful and interesting program in Oregon. And one that our organization has been supporting. So I think charter schools offer that kind of option. Magnet schools, private schools, home schools. I mean, the options are, the array is available. The question, I think, in the bill is really whether or not you start taking stable generally, and I think to call them stable in this funding environment is stretching the point, but to take stably funded school districts and begin breaking them up around issues that don't address the finance question, which is so fundamental to a stable school district, is where the problems begin to arise. And having the option of charter schools in a district is the kind of safety valve that certainly has been a success in a number of districts.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, Brian Reeder from the Department of Education. Again, the department is solidly neutral on this bill. I did want to share some information with you, primarily information that came out of the small school study that the department did last year. One of the conclusions of that study, or one of the exercises, was to look at district size and how it affects the costs of serving students. And what we found is that district size does matter. At very low district sizes, costs are substantially higher. Then they fall fairly dramatically and then rise slowly again as districts get larger. The minimum cost district size, based on the research that we did, was somewhere under 10,000 students. To me, what that says in relationship to this bill is that in some circumstances, for example, the Morrow County situation, where if that breakup occurs, the Ione School District will be roughly 150, 160 students. That's a very small district. There are some inherent inefficiencies in running a district that size. The district is not going to get any more money from the state for being small, and they may have real problems providing an adequate program for their students. But this bill cuts both ways. On the other end of the spectrum, a district the size of Portland or Beaverton or Salem that are all over 30,000 students, Portland nearly 50,000 students, there may be some efficiencies from splitting those districts into smaller units. All of this has to be taken in the context of the communities that these schools and these districts serve. The financial part of it is only a piece of the puzzle, and in some cases it may not be the most important piece. I think what's driving the situation in Morrow County is primarily whether a school will be allowed to remain open in Ione. And if it's not, the consequences for that community are very large. So in that sense, looking simply at the finances of running the school is not enough. You need to look at the impact on the community as well. Having said that, I don't really know what to say about this bill. It has, you know, it has some, I think, some potential to create efficiencies in some situations. It may create inefficiencies in others, but that's only part of the story.
Thank you very much. Two more witnesses, Ray Grady and Sharon Brandstetter.
Could I join these people?
I would like for you to do that, Representative.
Should we vote on that, or should we?
Please do. We're running out of daylight.
Make it quick and painless.
It's getting dark.
Yeah.
Chairman Starr, thank you for giving that. For the record, I'm State Representative Alan Brown from House District 10. Thank you, Chairman Starr, for giving me the opportunity to join these folks here. They're from the largest portion of my district is Lincoln County. It's a countywide school district. We have four high schools. And we're like, just like the other school districts around the state, struggling to find dollars to balance our budget and in this year and to deal with that budget situation in the upcoming year. There's been, we closed one school at Eddyville last year. There's been a lot of turmoil within the district. The school board, four members out of five on the school board last year were recalled. And so you can see there's a lot of dissension and concern in our district. There's been in their search to find ways to balance the budget. There's been talk from a local committee about closing additional schools, and one of that discussion was the Walport School. And these people that are with me today here will be able to fill you on that. And I appreciate that. Chance to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Senator Starr, Senators, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm Ray Grady. I live in Walport, Oregon, and represent the group that's gathered down there. I prefer to read this. You have copies of it because there are a lot of facts and figures in here, and I'd like, if I look away from them, I'm not going to see them again. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 283. I've been a resident of South Lincoln County for over 50 years, with my brother, owned and operated Grady's Market until the sale of that store 8 years ago. I am currently a member of the committee's Save Our K-12 Schools Committee, and we believe that we have an immediate and critical need for the passage of Senate Bill 283. We are prepared to lend our complete support to assure its passage. We had 500 people in our gym when these issues came forward. You need to know that. A little background. On January 28, 2003, during a combined Lincoln County School Board and Budget Reduction Task Force presentation, the district announced that having failed to find a full $2.7.2 million in savings, that it was left with no other fiscal option but to consolidate its smaller school operations. While acknowledging that closure of schools would undoubtedly cause significant hardships, i.e. busing for 2 to 4 hours per day for the majority of students, curtailment of extracurricular after-school activities, loss of enrollment, etc., the South County was formally informed that its Walport Middle and or its Walport High School was being officially targeted for closure. Recognizing the very real and negative educational and socioeconomic impact of our school's closure, our community's business, education, and civic leaders immediately formed an ad hoc committee to save our K-12 schools. Our committee first met on February 5, 2003, and has been meeting weekly since. From our inception, we have clearly understood that if we are to save K-12 education in South County, that we will need to develop credible, fiscal sound arguments for the district's and board's consideration. After weeks of effort to objectively analyze, quantify, and qualify the operational costs of our district and our local schools, we have come to believe that a fiscal viable option, and one that is in our best interest, and is to form a smaller, independent South County school district. Below, you'll see the data for our schools in South County. We have 284 students in the high school, 230 in the middle school, 360 K through 5, for a total of 879. The latest ODE report cards indicate that the students in South County are above the county average in achievement in nearly all areas. The Walford High School students are not only tops in the Lincoln County School District, but also rank very high in the state of Oregon. Some projected economic impact on South Lincoln County. Net personal income loss to the South County with the closure of Walford High School is calculated at $1,529,581. Net personal income loss to South County with the closure of Walport Middle School is calculated at approximately $1.1 million. In terms of workforce, we would lose 29 FTEs from Walport High School out of the South County, covered workforce of 946 people. The per capita income of South County is $15,900, and the poverty rate is 17.3%. Closure of Walport Middle School would result in a direct loss of an additional 23 FTE to our workforce. Those are in-plan numbers from 2003. This does not take into effect the long-term loss to South County that will surely occur due to the fact that families will not locate where there is not a local school. Social impact on the students and the families. On the back of your handout, you have a complete letter that Arthur Roberts wrote. I've just pulled kind of the center out of it for this testimony, but we leave it to you for your reading later. Dear Gene Turner, Sunday afternoon, and Gene Turner is our newly appointed Board of Directors member from South County. She's been only in, what, two months?
About that, yeah.
After the recall that Alan mentioned. I'm glad to learn you live in the Walport-Yahats area and are open to input from area residents. I know the board faces difficulty in budgeting, but closing Walport High School is just not a viable option. In the short and long runs, the economic costs, and I've inserted currently estimated about $1.5 million immediately for South County, for everyone would far outweigh immediate savings. As former Yahats City Councilor and Mayor, I understand what schools mean to communities economically and socially. Students are not digits to be tallied, but are persons who live and find their social meaning within a distinct community. Our nation rightly set up a bicameral system so that people are represented not just by aggregate number, but also by regional identity. So Rhode Island and Alaska receive recognition, as well as New York and California. Lincoln County School District should likewise recognize the meaning of community in the lives of students and their families. I suggest the board consider another alternative to closing schools that serve a central community function. Calculate whether the district should be divided. Consolidation is sometimes cost-effective, but if size makes too large and cumbersome administrative staff, smaller may actually be more effective and economical. It may be in this case. If so, ask the state to divide the district. Thanks for listening, Arthur Roberts. I've listed for you some other successful small Oregon school districts. Our community has requested and received from four small districts their financial data for use as models for our proposed new district. At this writing, none of these districts have had to cut student days, whereas Lincoln County School District has already cut 12. Excuse me. Sharon just tells me that now it's 15. There are many more of these in the state of Oregon, and their information is readily available. And I give you this list of the four districts, Harrisburg, Scio, Jefferson, and Oak Ridge, which most happen to be in the same athletic conference that our folks are in. And then below, I've inserted again the enrollment from the Walport area in South Lincoln County to show you how similar that is to these other districts that are functioning quite well. And I would agree that 1991 to 2003, it's high time to look at some of this, because these districts are functioning properly. They aren't having some of the same problems the larger districts are. Popular, I don't care what the school district boards say. South Lincoln County commitment to passage of Senate Bill 283. We believe it is well-founded and needed widely in the state of Oregon. Bigger districts are not necessarily better districts, as evidenced in other rural areas. We are doing our homework and will share our new district model as it becomes more fully developed based on credible financial information. Thank you for your time, and especially for your interest in community-based education for the young people of our great state of Oregon.
Yes.
I tend to support what you're talking about. But I don't know how you arrived at the fiscal the bottom of the first page, net personal income loss, is that per year?
That's for salaries in the first year, yes.
The first year, okay.
Yes. That's the initial impact. That's not a multiplier of what happens when somebody leaves the area and that type of thing. We didn't factor that. Those are just salaries in both cases for both schools.
Thank you very much. We're running late, and I want to certainly let folks know that this is the last bill we're hearing today, and it is hearing only because that's what it's scheduled for. If you could make your comments brief.
I can't.
I know you can't.
I've never been able to do that.
All right.
And I was afraid we would come at the end of the day.
Yeah.
See, I'm still mad about Eddyville closing. I'm sorry.
Good.
I drive through there.
We've had the opportunity to listen to COSA and Oregon School Boards Association twice in the time I've been sitting here, so I'd like something equal to their time. I'm Sharon Brandstetter, and I'm the mayor of the city of Toledo. And I have lived and worked in Lincoln County since 1950, when I was a child. And I have taught, I've been a teacher, an administrator, and a counselor for the Lincoln County School District for 35 years. And in the five-year recess I took from that, I was elected to the Toledo Local School Committee, and then I was elected to the Countywide School Board, where I served with Mr. Grady's brother. And in the years of working with the Lincoln County School District, it has not served as a very good model for how to organize schools in the best interest of communities and the children who attend those schools. It made sense to keep that model prior to passage of ballot measure 5 because it allowed us to spread the equity of assessed evaluation over our entire county, so we didn't have poor districts and rich districts. Today, with ballot measure 5 and all the succeeding measures, we no longer need to worry about that type of equity. We have equity in guaranteeing that every child is worth so many dollars, and those are the dollars that we have to use to educate our children. I appreciate State Representative Brown's comments on the school board, but I want to go back to that because they were in my notes, too, and I don't want to confuse myself. But Lincoln County held a very successful recall of its school board members in November of this year after a very successful petition drive to bring that to a vote. And when that vote had over 70% of the registered voters in Lincoln County participate in it. The people of Lincoln County are dissatisfied with the organization of its school district. And the funding crisis that we're in now has only made that more evident of the long-standing dissatisfaction in Lincoln County of how we organize our school and carry a fairly significant overhead in district office administrative costs. Because of the size of our school district, our superintendent earns a salary of at least $124,000 a year, putting him in competition with districts the size of Eugene and Corvallis and much larger districts. Our COSA, I hear COSA testify as opposed to this kind of breakup also, an organization of that size inflates salaries. It's an inflationary process when you grow larger. For one, your bargaining units have a much broader sphere of influence and can your teachers' unions, and I'm a part of that, I'm part of that process, but I've also understood how the process impacts inflation of salaries and benefits. As the mayor of Toledo, I understand that in our, you know, we have a budget, this is how much money we have, this is how much police can get and firefighters and all of the above. So the county unit system has not been and continues not to be a very good model. And so I, too, in the city of Toledo, because after Walport closes, Toledo's the next closure. You see, they'll come after us, too, because we're the next size school to lose its student body for more consolidation. And so my plea to you, and I approached the current school board on the 14th of January, and I asked them to create a countywide committee, of which I would be more than happy to either participate or chair, and create a countywide committee to study the reorganization of the Lincoln County School District into smaller districts. And I have been invited to return on March 11th to be on the agenda of that board meeting to present that proposal. And the current board, who may not be following all the dictates of the larger parent organization, the Oregon School Boards Association, these current school board members understand why they were elected and why they're there, and that's to serve their constituents and try to understand how we can better provide education in Lincoln County. And so I appeal to you today to seriously consider passage of Senate Bill 283 and let the Lincoln County School District get on with the business of protecting its smallest schools, but not at a cost increase to the state of Oregon to operate. You know, we have the wisdom to understand how to organize our schools within the existing dollars, but to give us that opportunity to, in fact, do that. And so I appeal to you, please do not drop this. Please let this go on, and let us take a look at how to preserve what we have that's important to our communities.
Thank you very much. Questions? I appreciate the testimony. This is not a mandate for breaking up school districts. It is an opportunity, though, for local districts to get together and look at how they might organize. I think that this bill is up for hearing only today. We're going to take a further look at it, and we will likely bring it back for work session. But if we don't, it's because we don't have the votes for it.
May I ask a question then about that process? Is there any further opportunity for us to represent our county and our cities and address how we can assist in moving this forward?
I think that certainly we'll give you that opportunity. And with the help of your state representative, perhaps we can figure out how we'll do that.
May I say something? I support this idea, and I know that it's... but I have a really, really, really great concern with the small communities losing the glue that holds them together, which is their school. And I think that... And I was sorry to see Eddyville close, and I followed that because... I mean, we drive through Eddyville.
That's right. It was wrong.
But the people who, you know, the busing of those kids through the mountain, you know, through the windy roads and snow, and I don't know if they all have snow tires on the bus.
Not needed, Senator.
But, no, I have a great deal of empathy for that, and so I just think it's important that we keep the small schools intact. So
right.
I'm interested in this, and I'll...
See, some people might want to come to you and say that breaking up the Lincoln County School District would return and create a single district the size of Eddyville with only 130 students. That may not be the model at all.
Yeah.
That school might roll into East County School District, which would be Toledo, Siletz, and Eddyville.
Yeah.
So.
I'm sorry. So I know it's getting late, but we came a ways, and we have
right,
a critical issue, and I know you sense that it's very important to us. Eddyville is a good example. I got figures from the Lincoln County School District 10 days ago. I asked them what happened to the students out of that school, 143 students. 36% of those students went out of the school district. $250,000 went away from the district. They missed their estimate by $400,000 on that transfer. Saved them nothing. Saved the county nothing to do. 45% of their high school students, 9 through 12, left the district. That's the community total. We anticipate already, in fact, one of the math teachers in high school has put a survey out with the help of Oregon State. And that survey is going to be amazing when it comes back. We estimate that we're going to probably have a minimum of 50 students, and it looks more like 100 to 120 now that will not stay within the district at $5,000 apiece. We already have the number down, the saving for the district, at about less than $300,000 to close our high school. And they're not listening. So
appreciate it very much. Thank you very
appreciate
very
help.
Much.
We want to be here every time. So we
thank
help.
You, Chair.
All right. Thank you.
So you want to get
we're
here.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 283.
Mm-hmm.
And close the
okay. Get Mayor Torrey to come and testify because
okay.
You graduated okay. From Walport High School.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.